Jack McCallum joins us on Sports Byline USA. If you're looking for a good book to read, let me recommend one to you. Dream Team, How Michael, Magic, Larry, Charles, and the Greatest Team of All Time Conquered the World and Changed the Game of Basketball Forever. And it ushered in an interesting era in basketball in the Olympics, Jack. Go back and give us a little bit of a history lesson about how the decision was made to go ahead and utilize NBA pro players.
Well, the tradition in our country was that we would send our collegians over to our best college players. There were two reasons for that. It was tradition in our country, but also the NBA players were barred, specifically barred by the rules of FIBA, the International Basketball Organization. They were not allowed to play in the Olympics, even though the other countries had de facto professionals. You know, they just happened to call them policemen and firemen and soldiers and whatever else. But one guy from FIBA, a fellow named Boris Stankovic, who turned out to be the chief of FIBA eventually, really had the idea that this was unfair, that we should have our NBA players, and moreover, that the only way the game was truly going to grow overseas was if the NBA players were participating. And a lot of people think it was the NBA that, you know, sort of put into motion the plan to play in the Olympics. It wasn't. The NBA was resistant to the idea at first, but eventually it grew on them. We lost in 1988, and so the idea that we needed someone else beside collegians became palatable, and that led to the formation of the Dream Team that won the gold in 92.
In 1992, I was up in Portland, Oregon. They had the NBA draft up there, did the show out of there, and I remember the announcement of the team. Tell me a little bit about the jockeying and behind the scenes that went into picking that team.
Well, it was a difficult thing because some of the players, Michael Jordan, for various reasons, Larry Bird, were kind of coy about whether or not they were going to play. So it was sort of like I likened it to kind of the graduation party. You want the cool kids to be there, but if the cool kids weren't going to come, you got to keep the next kind of coolest kids on ice, and in case you need them for the party. So they got a break early, though, the selection committee. Magic Johnson right away said, I want to play. Magic was in with both feet. You know, he had missed it in 1980. There was a boycott, and he was a rookie in the league anyway. I don't know whether he would have played. And when he kind of joined in, suddenly it became sort of the cool thing to do. And they kind of picked the team without too much turmoil until they came to the selection of Isaiah Thomas, who as a player probably deserved to be on the team, but was unpopular among some of the main guys, specifically Michael Jordan. So the biggest controversy to this day remains that Isaiah Thomas was excluded.
Was there some challenges as far as how to deal with this team? Because, again, as you've already pointed out, it was college players before, and now we're talking about big-name professional players who were used to the best of everything.
Well, these guys made pretty much of the big worry about the Dream Team was that it would be a chemically unbalanced mix, that there was too many good players on it. And I think from the beginning that these guys were not only stars, and with that comes a lot of ego and everything, but they were also at the point in their career when they were pretty smart basketball players. And the key to any basketball team is getting the main guys. And they got Magic, Michael, and Larry to buy in right away, and they formed a kind of leadership triumvirate that really understood how to approach this. And somehow they were able to beat teams by 40, 50, 60 points and not really look like they were rubbing it in. And in retrospect, that is one of the great gifts of this team, and it's a credit both to those guys but also to Chuck Daly, who was the perfect kind of coach for that team. He just knew how to handle big-time superstar players.
Yeah, you bring up a very good point because Mike Krzyzewski is a good friend, and he told me a little bit about that coaching staff. It was very interesting in which he was part of it as an assistant coach. Tell me about how the coaches approached this.
Well, Mike Krzyzewski was a great resource for the book. I mean, his institutional memory, honestly, of this team was as good as anyone I talked to. Mike had a very funny anecdote, which was the first time that they were going to go in and talk to Chuck Daly. And Mike at that time was not, you know, quote, Mike Krzyzewski in capital letters. I mean, he was a great college coach, but he and P.J. Carlesimo, the other assistant coach who were collegians, went in for the first meeting with Chuck Daly, and they're wondering what he's going to say and start dispensing all this, you know, amazing blackboard advice and all this kind of stuff. And Chuck told him one thing. He said, guys, you got to learn to ignore. And what he meant was coaching an NBA team, and particularly coaching the superstars of superstars, meant that they're going to do things their own way, that you got to be careful. Don't ride them. Don't sweat the small stuff. The only thing you got to do is channel their energy toward getting ready to play a game, and probably you don't even have to do that. And at the end of the day, what the Dream Team needed was just kind of that quiet, steady voice of Chuck Daly.
How difficult was it, or were they concerned in any way, Jack, about the fact that the game is played with only one basketball?
That was going to be the big decision. And when the guys, actually, what happened first was that there was too much consciousness that nobody wanted to be selfish, and they had an early scrimmage against some college all-stars. And guys like Bobby Hurley, Chris Webber, Allen Houston, Grant Hill, Penny Hardaway came in there and beat this team in a scrimmage because for a couple different reasons, but the number one reason probably was that they were passing the ball too much, that they were unwilling. Nobody wanted to be kind of a show-off from the beginning. They were sort of unwilling to go into their NBA isolations. And from that moment on, after the college team beat them, they were able to kind of figure out a compromise, how to play a passing, unselfish game and still incorporate, you know, hey, once in a while we have to isolate Michael over there. Once in a while we got to get the ball to Barkley underneath. And once they figured that out, you know, they didn't have any trouble winning basketball games.
You know, Jack, knowing the personalities, the big four you mentioned in the title of the book, Michael, Magic, Larry, and Charles, to me, when I think about them and their personalities, I just don't know how they put that team together. Tell me a little bit about the interactions of those four to each other that allowed this team to play and come together the way they did.
Well, I think they were, you have to take Charles out of that a little bit and remember that the three guys, there is absolutely no question the main three guys on that team, you can't overestimate it, were Magic Johnson, Larry Bird, and Michael Jordan. And Magic acted as kind of the ceremonial captain. I don't mean that to sound worse than it is. I mean, Magic was still a great player at that point. But Magic handled the kind of microphone duties. Larry Bird was able to defer to Magic because he didn't really like that kind of thing anyway. His was a little more introverted personality. And his, you know, he was really played in a lot of pain over there, and he didn't want to really be out front. But when the time came for Bird to say something, he did. Michael Jordan made the decision early that, look, Magic and Larry saved this league. They deserve to be captains. But let's get one thing clear. When we're on the court, I'm the man. I'm the kind of, quote, captain on the court. And they really, the three of them, came to an understanding about that. And Charles kind of got into this, you know, I mean, there were some people said he wouldn't even make the team. I mean, he had gotten into a lot of trouble. At that point, he was not, you know, certainly on their level. But Charles describes really growing from that experience. I mean, the following year when they came back from Barcelona, Barkley was the MVP of that season. So his game and his reputation took a giant boost by being with those players in Barcelona.
A lot of people may not know, but Larry Bird, one of the great trash talkers in professional basketball, and in your book you tell some very funny Larry Bird trash talk stories. Share a couple with us.
Well, Bird was I was very surprised at how every one of these guys almost had some Larry Bird story. And the one that sticks with me was David Robinson. The first time he's gone up against the court, the first time he's going to go up against Bird, this is probably probably 1988, David's rookie year. I mean, he doesn't even know whether Larry Bird knows him, you know. And Larry Bird gets the ball early, and David comes out on a switch high, and Larry looks at him and goes, "This is in your eye, David." And he just proceeds to shoot this kind of dead-eye jumper. And I said to Robinson, well, did he make it? And Robinson said, well, of course he made it. You know, he's Larry Bird. So Bird had this kind of quiet gunslinger aspect because you never knew that he was really talking and getting into people's heads, but he definitely was that type of player.
How hurt was Larry Bird for that tournament?
Larry Bird was in, I'm going to say, and this is no fake, because I had somewhat followed him that season, and the season before I had done a book on the Celtics, Bird was a lot of time in excruciating pain. I mean, if Larry Bird was in a game, that meant that somehow the team doctors and his personal physiotherapist who traveled with him, a guy named Dan Dyrick, had gotten Larry ready to play. If Larry was not in the game, that meant Larry was in pain. So he was about a 50% performer in the Olympics, but it just kind of showed that, you know, it's not like you really needed him. It's like, you know, you got 50% out of Bird. He was pretty good when he was good, but when he couldn't play, he didn't play at all. So he came back subsequently and retired. He realized in Barcelona that he had endured all the pain that he was going to.
Jack McCallum is with us. It's a wonderful book. We're going to make it a selection of the month on the Sports Byline USA Book Corner. It's called Dream Team. We'll continue talking with Jack as we continue across the country and around the world with you on Sports Byline.